The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. Welcome to our 2010 Holiday Book Buying Gift Guide. Now, over the holiday season, do remember that gift refers to the presents that you buy for your friends and family, but it also covers the presents you buy for yourself. Today, I have some lovely and rather eclectic readers on the line to talk about their favorite books. We'll be joined by astronomer Nicole Gallucci, psychotherapist Dana Blumrosen, and writer and actor Kennedy Goodkey. So let's set the tone with the first of some of the short reviews that we'll be sprinkling liberally throughout the show.
Hi there, this is Michael Cruz. I'm a paramedic in the Toronto area, as well as one of the co-chairs for the Committee for the Advancement of Scientific Skepticism at CFI Canada. And I'm here to tell you about Ben Goldacre's Bad Science. It basically is a crash course on the scientific method and how it applies mostly to medical research and how it's reported in the media. First of all, he tells stories that are very interesting to listen to. And his indignation comes out in a very witty way, so it's a delight to read. He looks at more of the mainstream hucksterisms like Brain Gym and homeopathy, which is much bigger in Britain than it is over here, as well as the myriad ways that the pharmaceutical companies have attempted to circumvent the peer review process and get their drugs approved, right? So he doesn't focus on sort of outliers in the alt-med community. He sort of indicts everybody for their bad science, which is really excellent. He also takes special aim at the media. He focuses on the conflation by the media of the MMR scare in Britain and really goes from sort of the absurd to the sublime inside the book as well. So it's a great read. I would recommend it for anybody who enjoys understanding how medical research works. And the second book I'd like to talk about is called Drew Birch's Taking the Medicine. A bit more academic, but really fascinating look at the history of the development of the modern clinical trial in medicine, starting at the early development of medicine, modern medicine in like the 18th century, and takes us right through the development of aspirin, antibiotics, into the thalidomide scare, and into the modern development of even things like cardiac antiarrhythmics. Now, it gets a bit technical, but it's still written for the layperson. It's not, you don't have to be a doctor or a medical person to understand it. The essential kernel of the book is that humans make mistakes, and that the modern clinical trials really developed out of a need to know exactly what's going on and try to get rid of all the bias. So I would recommend both those books for anybody who's interested in the history of medicine and how we know what we know in medicine and the shortcomings of personal opinion, which I think is really, really important.
Hi, I'm Heidi Anderson, and I am the founder and editor of SheThought.com, and I live in Spartanburg, South Carolina. My favorite science book is Your Inner Fish by Dr. Neil Shubin. I grew up knowing that evolution was real, but no one ever really explained evolution to me, so I just didn't really understand it. And it wasn't until I had a child and had to explain it to him that I actually started to learn about evolution. But what is fascinating about this book is Dr. Shubin actually found one of the first transitional fossils. He and his researchers were thinking that if there was going to be this type of creature, it would have existed in a certain time period, and it would look like this. And based on those clues, it's almost like a mystery, because he's got those clues, and it's the story of him searching for this creature. And, you know, spoiler alert, he finds it, and it's called Tiktaalik. I saw the book and read the book, and the idea that I would have been excited at how you could use geology to look for a certain type of creature, I didn't understand that before, but this book really helps you understand that Dr. Shubin and his research team knew if they were going to find this creature, that it was going to be based in a certain time. And so then they use that with geologists to figure out where would the fossil be and what type of rock. And it went exactly how he thought it was going to. It just took him a lot longer. And so if you're the type of person who maybe doesn't come from a science background in terms of your career, or you weren't raised with it, to me, Your Inner Fish helps you see it almost in a narrative fashion, that his story is so compelling, but I also learned so much about science while reading it.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we're talking about our favorite science books. And by we, I mean me and three past guests of the show that I enjoyed immensely and wanted to hear from again. With me today are Kennedy Goodkey, Nicole Gallucci, and Dana Blumrosen. Why don't you all introduce yourselves, guys, starting with Nicole.
Hi, I'm Nicole Gallucci. I'm a grad student in astronomy at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. I also really like doing a lot of outreach. We have an outreach group called Dark Skies Bright Kids, which we go visit elementary schools and teach them about astronomy. And I love books.
And how about Dana?
Hello, everybody. I'm a psychotherapist practicing in currently extremely stormy Santa Cruz, California, and I'm a former math and science phobe who now loves math and science books, and I'm ready to help you convert or at least tickle the interest of the humanities-loving masses and family members that you may have.
Nicely put. And Kennedy.
Hi, my name's Kennedy Goodkey, and I'm a filmmaker in Vancouver, British Columbia. Look for my movie, The Beast of Bottomless Lake, at science fiction conventions and festivals near you. And, yeah, I also am a big lover of science.
First of all, thanks very much for coming back to the show, guys.
My pleasure.
Ooh, glad to be back.
Nice to be here.
So we have a lot of books to talk about today. Some science classics that we think should be on every shelf, and some recent ones that people absolutely must add to their collection. So in Michael's clip that just played, he mentioned the mistakes that were made throughout medical history. And Dana also wanted to talk about another mistake-oriented book.
My first pick of the year is The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks by Rebecca Skloot. Because I'm representing science phobes out there, I really understand that science can be an intimidating sell for folks who come from the humanities and who may have had a traumatic academic relationship to math and science. So because I can empathize with that, I understand that it's nice to wrap that in a sweeter package, sort of like putting cheese on broccoli. This is not about it being condescending. It's about providing the gateway drug that gets people who love to read into science books. So The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks is a super compelling biography that teaches cell biology through this biography of the young African-American woman named Henrietta Lacks, whose cells were taken, and they are now known as HeLa cells. They were taken in the 50s without her permission while she was dying from cancer, without any notification of her family. And they've been bought and sold by the millions without a cent of profit to her surviving family members. And the book follows what happens to her remaining family members as they learn, as the reader learns, about how the HeLa cells became so famous and so helpful. The book would appeal to someone whose interest is in history or who is compelled by stories of how mid-20th century scientific decisions and discovery intersect with the history of racism, and who appreciate a really compellingly written investigative journalism kind of style of writing, which Skloot has. It also shows why people who don't understand the scientific process might have a really deep and historical basis for fearing it. And like Michael mentioned before, the book is about as much how science can be fallible and biased towards other human beings as it is about making these amazing leaps forward and helping people through the scientific discovery. And then you'll also learn about cell biology as a bonus.
When you're speaking about that, are you speaking as a psychotherapist or as a layperson then?
I am totally speaking as a layperson. My interest in science books came directly through brain science stuff, and so I was incredibly intimidated about stuff like cell biology. And I probably, like many people, wouldn't have picked up this book if it wasn't wrapped in the incredibly compelling biography package.
Okay, next up, a book that also is definitely for laypeople of all kinds, Kennedy, A Brief History of Nearly Everything.
Bill Bryson's Short History of Nearly Everything tries really hard to live up to its name, and of course, it has to fail. But it's so entertaining in the process that it's totally worth the read. He sort of explains at the beginning that he found that most science was not pitched at him, and he found it really frustrating, and he wanted to understand it better. So he spent 3 years talking to professors and so forth about various aspects of science, from the beginning of time through to human biology and evolution. And he spends the book kind of exploring how these things work in sort of a cursory way. But more than anything else, the biggest thing about the book is the stories behind how things were discovered. He'll talk about one discovery, but also say, well, you know, this was standing on the shoulders of giants sort of situation. Here are the people who came before that made it possible for Edwin Hubble to, you know, make his discoveries. It's faulty. It's certainly worth checking out the errata online. Like in the first two chapters, he manages to give us what is now an outdated theory on the future of our universe. And he also, in the second chapter, tells us about the solar system from the perspective of the ninth planet, Pluto.
So, awkward.
Sure, many listeners know. The controversy of Pluto being a planet was alive when he wrote the book, so he sort of takes it from that angle. It's just he comes to a conclusion which we no longer adhere to.
How in-depth do these pieces get then?
Not very.
Okay.
It's hard to really answer that because there's so many that some he really just sort of gives a grace note to, but other he puts some effort into explaining or at least giving a sort of pop science overview of everything from, well, the solar system to super volcanoes.
So then who is this book for? Would it make an astronomer upset, for example? Nicole, maybe you can answer that. Would that make you upset?
Probably not, but it may seem too much like work for me.
Right.
Well, then you skip those chapters, right?
Yeah.
So who's the book for then? Who would you suggest it to?
I would suggest it to somebody who is just starting to get the bug of science. And maybe people who are a little deeper, who have, everybody has their specialty, so you might know everything there is to know about super volcanoes, but not know much about evolution. There's going to be a chapter in there for just about everybody at some point. Like I said, the book is largely about the stories behind how the science came to be understood.
I think the theme of today's show is gateway drug.
Word.
Nicole, you're up. One of your picks was Death from the Skies.
So as I mentioned, reading astronomy books is kind of like work to me. So I tend not to read many astronomy books, except I had to pick up Death from the Skies because, you know, I love Phil Plait's blog and it's awesome. And I was surprised. I could read this book and really enjoy it and get a lot out of it, even though, you know, all the scientific explanations are stuff I've had on my qualifier. And it was still really entertaining for me. And it's also, I think I passed this one on to my boyfriend at some point. It's really entertaining for someone who doesn't have a science background because it breaks down the physics in a way that is interesting and accessible for anybody. And it basically talks about all the ways in which things in the universe are trying to kill you. He puts these little like fictional vignettes at the beginning of each chapter describing some, you know, apocalyptic movie scenario of this horrible thing actually happening. And you don't actually want to read that before bed, unless you actually have time to read the chapter and talk about the science and the actual probability that any of that's really ever going to happen to you.
This is definitely a book that's considered a science classic in a lot of circles.
Yeah.
So
yes.
Why do you think that is?
Just the way he explains the astronomy is really novel in a lot of ways. And I think, oh, why didn't I think to explain it that way when I was teaching?
Such raw readability.
Yeah, and it's got stuff blowing up. I mean, who doesn't love stuff blowing up? So between stuff blowing up and having a really good conversational tone, that's probably why it's one of the must-have science books.
Kennedy, did you have anything to add? I know I thought I was going to have a cage match. Kennedy wanted to do this book as well.
I think this is the only duplicate we had out of the books we chose,
yeah.
Wasn't it? And when it comes to science communication, so many of the best communicators that we have and have had are astronomers. You know,
woohoo!
Sagan, Neil deGrasse Tyson, Phil Plait, noisy astronomer.
Thank you.
Yeah, I find that fascinating. That it's so consistent that narrow category has got such a wealth of people who are really great at explaining things well, and this is a perfect example.
I gotta say, another reason is we have such a cool topic to choose from. So, I mean, everyone likes stuff in the sky, and especially everyone likes, you know, apocalyptic scenarios with meteors and solar flares. So I guess
sells
we have
movie
something
tickets.
Easy to work with.
I think that's going to be the key for the science phobes, is the things blowing up and disasters.
Well, let's stay up in the sky for a moment with another clip.
My name is Jim Lippard. I'm a product manager for a managed security product and a PhD student in human and social dimensions of science and technology at Arizona State University. I live in Phoenix, Arizona, and I'm going to talk about Thomas Kuhn's The Copernican Revolution. The book is about the history of the Copernican Revolution from Aristotle to Newton. And I think a lot of people have an oversimplified understanding of the Copernican Revolution. What Kuhn's book does is shows all of the history that led up to the Copernican Revolution and how all the pieces fell into place, not with Copernicus and not with Galileo either. It really was when Kepler came along, and then Descartes and Huygens, and then Newton brought everything together. Thomas Kuhn was trained as a physicist, but then taught in history and philosophy science at UC Berkeley, Princeton, and MIT. But he ended up being far more influential in the sociology of science, in part because he argued for a relativistic notion of science, that different generations of scientists in different paradigms are really almost in different worlds, and the theoretical terms that they use are incommensurable. So there's no relation between the two, and there's not an accumulation of knowledge over time, which is almost a competing view to what most philosophers of science hold. There's actually a lot more in the book than what I just said, but it's a very important book for skeptics and anyone interested in how science works. It was probably the first major work that emphasized the importance of history to philosophy of science.
I'm very interested in science history, and often that's because that's the bit I can understand. So maybe, Dana, tell us about Mistakes Were Made.
Mistakes Were Made. This is by Carol Tavris and Elliot Aronson, who also lives in Santa Cruz with me. That's an excellent book. And that one really is one that I speak through as my psychotherapy self. This would be my choice for introducing fellow colleagues that people have maybe who are working in the social sciences to critical thinking and skepticism. And that's because it provides such vivid illustrations of the ways that we are predisposed to deceive ourselves into feeling like we're right. Whether that's in relationships or in arguments, and especially when we make mistakes. And the cool thing about it for me as a therapist is it provides great anecdotes to use in couples counseling. And it's kind of like a cautionary tale about being overly dogmatic. But the anecdotes are kind of split into two really cool areas. One is about historical examples from despots and dictators. And Carol Tavris and Elliot Aronson explain how those folks can sleep at night, which is fascinating, and how presidents can comfortably rehash their tenures without taking responsibility for massive mistakes that they have made. And then the other method that they use is to illustrate this is they take a couple arguing, a very typical couples counseling scenario, and they show you that the same methods that help the dictator sleep actually can also make you into a very bad partner or a bad listener. So ultimately, the end of this book is that they give you tips about how to overcome this tendency that we're all sort of driven to have, which is to prioritize our own beliefs over that of the other. And so it's also kind of like a gateway drug in terms of it being a hard science self-help book. And it's
nice.
Just a total joy to read.
I like that. I'm going to use that. Okay, so we have the past and we have the future. Kennedy, tell us about the Transparent Society.
Of all my picks, this is certainly the densest. It's by David Brin, who many people who would be listening might know him as science fiction author. I would argue the greatest living science fiction author, but, you know, that's another story. This is a nonfiction book, and it's him talking about, well, the cover says it all. Will technology force us to choose between privacy and freedom? And in short, he sort of suggests that we have a few choices with the way technology is advancing as to how we're going to proceed in dealing with our privacy, and that really, we're kind of lying to ourselves that we have an illusion of privacy, and that it kind of behooves us to sort of open up our minds a bit and embrace the options of of a transparent world, so that surveillance works in all directions, so it's both surveillance and surveillance, if you will, so that rather than having a Big Brother type world, We have a world where everyone has access to virtually all information. There are, of course, exceptions that are necessary. Rather than passing privacy laws that are going to be enforced by elites and trusting them to refrain from looking at us.
This is topical, is it not?
Yes, it sure is. Yeah, you certainly have to think of how it all applies to the, WikiLeaks is certainly the most immediate thing to discuss on these lines. But pick an aspect of your life. We all carry phones which have cameras in them. It's everywhere. And it's a book, it's a 10-year-old book by now, but I still find it absolutely fascinating and extremely under-championed, which is why I chose it.
Nicely done. And we'll be right back with more suggestions for books to buy for the sciency and not so sciency right after the break.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. You can email your questions for next week's episode to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, we're at Skeptical Radio, or use our handy question submission box on the website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also subscribe to the show in iTunes or listen to past episodes. And while you're there, why not add your review? Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. Check the media page at skepticallyspeaking.com to see if we air near you. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm here with writer and actor Kennedy Goodkey, astronomer Nicole Gallucci, and psychotherapist Dana Blumrosen. We're helping you find gifts for everyone on your holiday list, which is basically an excuse to talk about the books we love. Let's hear some more suggestions.
Hi, I'm Benjamin Radford. I'm managing editor of Skeptical Inquirer Science Magazine and a research fellow with CSI, the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry. I'm going to talk briefly about Carl Sagan's The Demon-Haunted World, Science as a Candle in the Dark. This is probably the best book on science in general that I've ever read. Carl Sagan was, of course, a famous astronomer and just a wonderful science popularizer. And one of the reasons I really like The Demon-Haunted World is that it covers so much in terms of why science is important. He goes into vaccines, he goes into the history of science and the history of pseudoscience and the importance of science in everyday life. And one of the things I really admire about the book is that he's not afraid to tackle the so-called paranormal topics, such as crop circles, ghosts, UFOs, satanic ritual abuse, and things like that. He doesn't dwell on them, but he recognizes that these are topics that are in the public's consciousness, and just ignoring them isn't going to do any good. For an overall survey of skepticism in science, Carl Sagan's The Demon-Haunted World has got to be the best. My second favorite, partly because I have a background in psychology, is Tom Gilovich's book, How We Know What Isn't So. Gilovich is a Cornell psychologist, and it's a fascinating book on the psychology of belief, why people believe things for which there's little or no good evidence. He goes into belief in luck, the effectiveness of alternative medicine. It brings a sharp scientific focus on many of these paranormal and sort of unexplained topics. Maybe not all of us are interested in UFOs or Bigfoot, but most of us experience people who believe in luck, or maybe we believe in luck ourselves. It's a quirk in our human belief system, in our brains, and Gilovich really explains how we fool ourselves in that. If you're interested in science from a psychological perspective, How We Know What Isn't So is a great place to start.
Ben Radford didn't mention any of his own books. I think that's probably unethical to do that. But Nicole, one of them was your pick.
Ben Radford came out with Scientific Paranormal Investigation, How to Solve Unexplained Mysteries. Book came out this year, and it's about how he has basically made a career out of investigating paranormal activity, things like, you know, hauntings and lake monsters, and how he's been able to solve these different cases. And I know he's got a new book on one of them coming out, The Chupacabra, which he has a chapter on. And it's really fascinating because, you know, it goes through how he solved a couple of these various cases and what he has in his toolkit and things an investigator should be aware of. And he makes a point that anyone can do this with a good common sense head on their shoulders. And yet, of course, I'm reading these stories going, I never would have thought of that. I never would have thought of that. I mean, clearly he's got a lot just from his experience doing this. But it was really interesting and a real refreshing break from the ghost hunter type shows on TV.
Right. And he has a very hands-on approach to investigating the paranormal.
Oh, yes. Yeah, you don't need an infrared camera to look for ghosts. Infrared cameras are awesome, but not for ghosts. You know, he shows up at the house and talks with the family and, you know, looks for drafts and all kinds of things like that. You know, has a regular camera with him to catch things, a microphone. So, yeah, he's there at the site looking for lake monsters.
You know, at this point, I'd like to mention a book. And I feel like it's almost a companion book. It's Martin Bridgestock's Beyond Belief, Skepticism, Science, and the Paranormal. Now, he talks about the history and the practice of that very evidence-based approach to analyzing the supernatural. But in the book, he also deconstructs a lot of the paranormal studies that have been done. And it is fascinating. It's more of an academic look at how we can understand those beliefs. But the writing is very charming and accessible and Australian. And I have a soft spot for Australians.
I think we all do around here.
So let's talk about some more people believing things without any evidence. Dana, you wanted to talk about Paul Offit's book.
Oh, I did. Paul Offit's book is just a total joy to read, partially just because it's such a, oh yeah, against in response to the anti-vax movement. The book that I particularly like, although I like a lot of Paul Offit's books, is Autism's False Prophets. It's basically the history of how the pseudoscience of the anti-vax movement was born. And it's Offit's really strong takedown of every single argument that the anti-vaxxers have ever made to date. And it's just a really well-written defense of science. And it has just this wonderful voice to it that is a little bit angry, but just is such a pleasure to inhabit. And, you know, I was a literature major. I just love good writing. And this is just really well-written. I know that the book is a little bit controversial, and it's not something to give to just a family member without knowing that they have some familiarity with the issues of vaccination. But for folks who might be on the fence, it just uses this super moving history of how vaccines came to be. And it just shows you that it's just one of the most significant scientific discoveries to impact human mortality in such a positive way. And it just makes you so proud to love science. So if you're in the mood for something that just gives you that, like, yeah, that's just a perfect book to read.
Now, if you did give this to someone who was not on the fence, who was squarely in the anti-vaccination camp, what kind of response could you expect?
I think you could have a pretty negative response. I actually naively had a neighbor come over to look at my new house, and they saw it on the shelf, and it immediately triggered a very intense conversation about it. And so he writes so well that it could actually really explain the argument to people who are just not familiar with the history of it.
Right.
But I think it could also antagonize family members that probably, as a psychotherapist, I would encourage you not to antagonize during this time of year. So pick correctly.
This is probably going to seem like the worst segue ever, but the anti-vaccination movement really does depress me. So let's talk about a lighter topic. Nicole, it's time to talk about charlatan.
Oh, sweet. All right. This is where I get to talk about goat gonads on the radio.
See, my segue makes sense in my head.
It's a perfect segue. And it's got some anti-science and medicine in there. So charlatan is by Pope Brock. And the tagline is, America's most dangerous huckster, the man who pursued him in the age of flimflam. And this was a really fun book. This was like a summer vacation reading book for me. It's great for anyone who, you know, doesn't think they have an interest in science or medicine. It's a really good human interest story about J.R. Brinkley, who is kind of a con man in the 19-teens and 20s and 30s. And he went from, you know, selling snake oil to actually selling this type of surgery to improve men's virility by implanting goat testicles into the man's. and obviously, it's hilarious and it's sad at the same time. It's hilarious because it involves goats. And it's sad because he left, you know, a trail, a not very well documented trail of illness and death behind him. Meanwhile, he built this $1 million fortune out of his goat gonad surgeries.
May I ask a question here about whether the book goes into the details of scrotal rejection or whether that's covered, because inquiring minds want to know, and that's really the thing that's going to bring science folks into the fold, is if this book goes into those details.
You are very right, Dana.
I know my customer base.
I don't think it goes into any graphic details, although there are a few sad cases of scrotal rejection by some of his less fortunate patients. And yet there are others that claimed that they had, you know, goat babies from from this surgery. Wow. They called them like goat boy and stuff. Yeah.
There are also other books about why people believe the things that they do. And here's one.
I'm Carly Sturgis. I'm a high school teacher in Australia, a student of the measurement of paranormal belief, and a podcaster for the Token Skeptic podcast. My favorite science book is one that I've worn to pieces over the last 3 years. It's called Believing in Magic, The Psychology of Superstition by Stuart Vicey. There's a real sense of embarrassment attached to superstition in many cultures, so people might be ashamed to admit what they do to secure good luck. But why is superstition so popular? Why do we still see lucky charms, lucky coins, a fear of black cats and the number 13 in modern times? Vicey's book draws from research in several disciplines to produce a thought-provoking analysis of modern-day belief in magic. He describes the way we desire control and certainty over our lives. Most superstitions are harmless, but they can occasionally be dangerous, and they lead people to be defrauded, maybe through compulsive gambling or seeking magical medical cures instead of sensibly consulting a doctor. For anyone who's curious about why superstitions are so common worldwide and how even the irrational can be quite rational at times, Believing in Magic, The Psychology of Superstition by Stuart Vicey is an essential read. For more recommendations on superstition and my research, you can head to my site at www.podblack.com or listen to the Token Skeptic podcast.
Now, this next clip really does have a bit of everything. There are some great suggestions, and I'd also like to point out that I will be interviewing one of the authors that she mentions next month.
Hi, I'm Ruth Seeley. I'm living in southern Alberta at the moment. I work as a PR person. Initially, my idea was to work with clean energy tech and nanotechnology people. So as an English major, I suddenly am acquiring nonfiction and science books at a fast and furious rate. Right now, I've just got my hands on a copy of Massive by Ian Sample. He's been a science correspondent for The Guardian since 2003, and I have to say this is storytelling at its best. The book focuses on British physicist Peter Higgs and his theory of mass, including the concept of the Higgs boson. But it's also a history of 20th century physics, and Sample is an extremely engaging writer. Each and every first paragraph of every chapter draws you in. The other book, of course, that I'm sure everyone has mentioned, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks by Rebecca Skloot. This really illustrated for me what creative nonfiction actually is, where the author is actually a character in the book saying, this is how I got this story and what I had to do to get it. Other books are Bright Sided, the Barbara Ehrenreich book. It's just out in paperback, and what's fascinating about it is it traces the positive thinking movement as a response to Calvinism in the U.S. and firmly showing that its roots are placed in the Christian Science movement. I first heard of her when I read her article online from Harper's Magazine called Welcome to Cancerland, in which she talks about her own problems with the breast cancer experience and, frankly, the pinkening of the whole breast cancer experience. Other books that I've bought this year that are just out, Robert Winston's Bad Ideas, and Arresting History of Our Inventions. Winston questions the value of many of our inventions, from fire to farming and from medicine to digital technology. Newton and the Counterfeiter, Tom Levinson's 2009 book, was just fantastic. Part of what makes it such a great read is its accessible style, but also the fact that Levinson doesn't try to take on all of Newton's life, but focuses on the period after he's essentially stopped doing science and started working for the Royal Mint. The other thing that I'd like to talk about a little bit is two books that will be coming out in 2011 that I'm really looking forward to. One is Alexis Madrigal's Inventing Green. It's basically a history of green technology, and it's a 150-year-long history that includes wind turbines, solar machines, electric cars. And most exciting for me, because I've read an early draft of the novel, is Stuart Clarke, the British astronomer's book, The Sky's Dark Labyrinth. It's going to dramatize key turning points in astronomical history, moments when our view of the universe changed. It's planned as a trilogy. It'll be out in March 2011. And the first book in the series talks about Kepler and Galileo. The other thing is, for a little bit of fiction, if that is your thing, I really loved Ian McEwan's Solar, a physicist whose best work is behind him and whose life implodes after he steals a colleague's work. It made me laugh out loud in parts. And then the last is the recently published The Honest Look by Jenny Rohn. The premise of this is that if you've accidentally discovered that a hyped drug is about to be released and yet it's fatally flawed, and how people react in this situation. I know that you've recently interviewed both Jennifer Ouellette, who's written The Calculus Diaries. I'm dying to read that one. And I also know that you've had Brian Switek on the show recently as well. I've been waiting and waiting and waiting for Written in Stone, Evolution, the Fossil Record, and Our Place in Nature to appear. It's finally out, and I'm hoping I might get it for Christmas. You never know.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we sit down with Joe Nickel, scholar, author, and veteran paranormal investigator, to talk about his experiences examining religious relics. We'll discuss his investigations of artifacts from all over the world, including weeping statues, saintly reliquaries, and even the infamous Shroud of Turin. Put a little science into your celebration next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 Mountain Time at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm joined by psychotherapist Dana Blumrosen, writer and actor Kennedy Goodke, and astronomer Nicole Gallucci, and we are talking about what we feel are the best science books ever. Now we have a couple of math books on the list. Kennedy, you have an interesting one.
It's funny you should refer to these as the best science books ever, because I just found out today, I was doing some additional research on this book, and in 1996, this book was on the short list for the Royal Institution's Award for the Best Science Book Ever Written.
Huh.
I'm talking about a play by Tom Stoppard called Arcadia. It's such a rich play. It touches on a number of different scientific disciplines, including chaos theory and thermodynamics and fluid dynamics. It is a fantastic read. I've seen it as well. I didn't even see a particularly good production, and it was fantastic. It's a play that takes place in two different times. I believe one is about 1809 and then currently, although currently is 93 when the play was written. All takes place in one room, and sometimes you'll have scenes both current and past going on. And it's just wonderfully complex. Tom Stoppard is one of the most brilliant playwrights alive. He won an Academy Award for Shakespeare in Love. And I would say that the complexity of Shakespeare in Love, like, this is sort of a similar ode but to science.
Well, I was going to say, I've read Stoppard. Now, is this going to make math more or less understandable?
I think what it's going to do is tease. It's not going to explain a heck of a lot. Within the first minute and a half of the play, they're talking about Fermat's Last Theorem, but he doesn't approach it in any way that is going to alienate people who have no idea how to approach math in their head. However, people who do have a preliminary understanding, who maybe don't know much about the concepts of chaos theory or what have you, is probably going to watch or read this play and come out the other side going, okay, I think I want to know a little more.
This is the most eclectic science book show ever. Dana, you have a math book that you'd like to talk about as well.
I'm so glad that you asked, because secretly, this is my favorite book of all four that I'm going to recommend. And I'm going to come out about something that's a pretty big deal in my life. I got a D in trigonometry when I was a junior in high school. Aww. I know, right? So although I love anything by Simon Singh, Fermat's Last Theorem, which I'm going to talk about, sat on my shelf for over a year. I'm like hugging it and holding it right now. Partially because it has a terribly unattractive cover, and it has this really unappealing quote from the Irish Times, which doesn't help the problem at all. It, you know, I just reinforced my fears that it was going to be abstruse and that it was going to make me feel shame, and yet it was the best thing that I've read this year. And I think that it single-handedly cured me of almost 40 years of math phobia, and it made me actually, I know, right? It actually made me read articles in the New York Times about math. I was like, yeah, I can read that now. It was that transformative, my experience. Okay, so what's great about this is it's written like a mystery, and it's enormously entertaining to read. He's just a terrific writer. He's really funny, and he has this unbelievable sense of what questions might come up for a math-naive reader as you're reading it. So you never feel exhausted, you never feel stupid. And as a bonus, he recounts the whole history of mathematics from ancient times to the present, and he includes biographical sketches of important mathematicians like Hypatia. And then he talks about how religiosity or sexism or the politics of the time intersected and then impacted their work. And sometimes it actually stopped their work or destroyed the library. But the really cool thing is that through all of that wonderful history, you never know until the end if the mathematician that he's talking about will or won't be able to solve Fermat's Last Theorem. And that part of the puzzle is just totally delightful. You can totally feel comfortable handing this to anybody who loves books, especially people who love mysteries. This was my gateway drug. This is the top book that I have to recommend of the year.
And we have one more math book in the clip.
I'm Austin Luton. I have a degree in physics, and I work for a company that does online education. People often ask me if I can recommend some books that they could read that would give them a basic understanding of physics without having to delve into a lot of the math that can make it really daunting to get a grasp of the subject. So I usually recommend Instant Physics by Tony Rothman. Instant Physics was a book that I picked up when I was with my father on vacation at the Toronto Science Museum, and this is the book that really got me interested in physics. It's accessible. There is some mathematics in it, but it's sequestered away, so you don't have to go into that if you really don't want to. But the important thing is that it's funny and fun to read. Dr. Rothman often has these little vignettes where he has these cocktail party conversations of a physicist who's talking to lay people. And it sort of parodies or satires the bizarre nature of a physicist's work and how it relates to his social interactions. But it always ties into some of the strange things he's been talking about in the book. He also has a lot of definitions. For example, I remember one part of the book where he's talking about the history of physics and geocentrism, which he defines as the belief that the Earth is the center of the solar system, and then heliocentrism, which is the belief that the sun is the center of the solar system, and then he has Presleycentrism, which is the belief that Elvis is the center of the solar system. And when I've been teaching physics myself, I have used a lot of the examples that he used in the book in Instant Physics as examples to my class when talking about centripetal acceleration, which is things going in a circle. He discusses having a rat on a string and swinging around your head. And usually you can get a couple of chuckles from the students, and that really helps people get more engaged.
So speaking of teaching, I realize that we haven't touched on any children's books yet. Nicole, you have one to talk about.
Yeah, so there's a series called Science Adventures with Max the Dog by Jeffrey Bennett, and I picked out Max Goes to Mars. It's about a dog, Max, who is actually Jeffrey Bennett's dog. And as he makes these travels throughout the solar system, and he's got a little doggy spacesuit, and it's got these really beautiful paintings of Max in these different places. So I think in one of the books, first he and his owner, Tori, go and establish a moon colony. And then in Max Goes to Mars, Tori has to stay home because she has to go to school, and But Max goes along and helps the astronauts. He actually like sniffs, or he has a special sniffer tool on his spacesuit helmet, and he sniffs for water. It's very cute.
And we have another kids book on the must buy list.
My name is Jason Jones. I'm one of the contributors to Wired.com's Geek Dad blog. I live in New Britain, Connecticut. And what I wanted to do today is talk about one of my favorite books for kids for 2010, which is Daniel Loxton's Evolution, How We and All Living Things Came to Be. This book is a gentle introduction to evolution, but it's a gentle introduction that doesn't talk down to kids. It shouldn't be too much of a surprise, since Daniel Loxton is the editor of the Junior Skeptic section of Skeptic magazine, and the book walks through both a overview of all the different things that go into evolution. So it talks about the discovery of fossils and the recognition that fossils really are the bones of extinct animals and not fancy things that we haven't discovered yet. And then he walks through the process of how Darwin discovered the idea of natural selection. And he does all of these things in a way that is just really clear and really easy to understand. And that's the first half of the book. Then in the second half of the book, he explains answers to all the different kinds of questions that you might have about evolution. What about transitional fossils? What about the eyes? Is there any evidence for evolution? He's got great illustrations all the way through. It's written in a voice that is witty without being kind of snarky or condescending, right? So there's a moment when he talks about how you might think that evolution is about survival of the fittest, which means that you have to produce the best and the brightest, but you may have realized that not all parents are Olympic athletes or geniuses. Yeah, and that's appealing to kids without being bratty. When it was time for me to review this book for Geek Dad, it disappeared. My son stole it. He was 6 years old at the time. He stole the book and was reading it on his own. It was so appealing to him that he wanted to read it and he wanted to look at it. And not only that, he was reading it so assiduously that I couldn't find it. And so any book that a kid will squirrel away about Darwin, evolution, and science is definitely one that lots of people should read.
I know. We all love that book.
Totally.
Daniel Loxton is so smart.
Daniel Loxton fan club.
Well, and this is the thing. Introducing kids to science is actually fairly easy as long as it's attractive and fun and not presented as work.
Yeah. It's actually the first book that I bought my daughter, actually. She's not quite up to that comprehension level at 3 months old, but
you have a prodigy.
I had to get it. Yeah.
Now, what do we do when we have an adult on our list that we think would really benefit from some science in their life, but you think that they may be hesitant or resistant? You have a book about that, Kennedy, sort of.
Oh, sort of. Yeah. Well, yeah, this is just an easy way in the back door, which I think many people need. Physics of the Buffyverse by Jennifer Ouellette. Really, she takes the world of Buffy the Vampire Slayer and its sequel, Angel, and uses those shows as an excuse to talk about all kinds of different scientific ideas. Now, in reality, the Buffyverse doesn't actually have a lot of real science in it. She tries to make an argument for it. I'm going to argue with her. But by the time you get past the introduction, it doesn't matter, because she just finds fantastic little excuses out of things that happen in the Buffyverse. She uses those to talk about different scientific subjects. She talks about how the properties of light and the optics of the eye, by using how vampires are not reflected in mirrors. She has an entire chapter on the physics of the fight. It's probably the one where the Buffyverse has the most real physics in it, where she explores mass and momentum and inertia and gravity and how that applies to kicking ass against the powers of the supernatural.
I like sneaky science. I support sneaky science.
Absolutely.
It's pure gateway drug.
I should say, though, if you haven't finished both series, spoiler alert.
So science does relate to people's interests and people's lives, and sometimes we as the science lovers just have to show other people how.
This is Jenna Marie Griffith. I am a graduate student at the University of Buffalo studying visual studies and art history, and that's in Buffalo, New York. And there's two books I'm going to talk about today, and they both deal with the influence of Darwinian theory on visual culture. There was a big shift in the latter part of the 19th century after Darwin published his first book on his theories. And we see a shift in a lot of art. A lot of art before then tends to be drawing specifically on historical ideas or ideas from myth. And people start to use science to back up some of the ideas that they're depicting, particularly ideas such as social Darwinism and the sort of primitive theories of race that happened at that time. And we can see images taken where formerly things would be classed and stratified simply on the basis of aristocracy or how much money somebody had. And now we're seeing things depicting native cultures in Africa and the New World as somehow being more primitive from an evolutionary stance. The other way it's depicted is in matters of sexual selection, an image that becomes very popular, especially in late 19th century painting. And this is the idea of the femme fatale. Somehow females are in charge of sexual selection. And these women are pathologized as literal predators, preying upon these poor, defenseless men. The other side of it goes back to the primitive nature. Basically, non-Western men are shown with almost gorilla-like and primate-like features, carrying off defenseless white women. And these were often shown as part of shows saying, you know, Darwin's dangerous theory. And in these two books, the first one's called The Art of Evolution, and it's edited by Barbara Larson and Faye Brower. And these are more academic essays which go through these various ideas. That one's a little more for the person very much interested in the background of image making. The other one that is a very, very glossy book is called Endless Forms, Charles Darwin and the Natural Science and the Visual Arts, which is a companion catalog to a show that was put on for the 150th anniversary of the publication of The Origin. This is more for the person who would like to really be able to delve into the imagery and make these comparisons. I highly recommend them both. They're both very fascinating to see how widely scientific theory pervaded culture in this instance. And for people that would like to see what happens when scientific theory is taken a little beyond its theoretical grounding.
Okay, we have history, we have pop culture, we have art. If the intersections of science and these topics still aren't what you're looking for, there's always sex.
Hi, my name is John Logson. I'm at the University of Iowa in the Department of Biology, where I'm an associate professor in the biology department. And I'm going to start with my most favorite book, Dr. Tatiana's Sex Advice to All Creation by Olivia Judson. This book is a lot of fun because it's written as an advice column, and Dr. Tatiana is an advice columnist. Think of Ann Landers, but a little dirtier. Organisms write to Dr. Tatiana with their questions about their sex lives. And so the kind of thing that is in the book is that an organism writes to Dr. Tatiana saying, you know, I'm a praying mantis, I'm a male praying mantis, and I'm really, really horny. But all of my male friends, whenever they got horny and they found a mate, they got their heads bitten off. So how is it that I can go and have sex and yet live for the next day? And then she responds by giving the reader a good quality evolutionary biology answer to the underpinnings of why sexual cannibalism might be favored. And it provides a really great framework for not only understanding sexual reproduction, but also understanding lots of things, weird things about biology. When you're reading this book in bed with your partner, and if your partner's reading another book or is just there doing something else, you're going to be laughing out loud. And they're going to say, "What's so funny?" If you read it out loud, they'll understand. On the topic of sex, I've also been reading a fair bit more popular literature with regard to human biology and human sexual biology. And there's a couple of books that I found really interesting in different ways. And the first one is called Why Women Have Sex. And it's by Cindy Meston and David Buss. And it's an evolutionary psychology take on, you know, sexual motivations in women and men, actually. And it's really well done. I don't necessarily have to accept all the conclusions that they bring forth, but it's a fairly eye-opening and interesting and data-laden book. The other evolutionary psychology book about human sexual biology is called Sex at Dawn, The Prehistoric Origins of Modern Sexuality by Christopher Ryan and Cecilda Jetha. So evolutionary psychology in its harshest mode takes a very strong natural selection view on behavior, and they take a little bit more nuanced view of the evolution of human sexuality. And I find it really interesting. I haven't actually finished the book, but I think it's worth reading, and it's very entertaining. The writing in it is very accessible. It's a very interesting and enjoyable read. For those of you who find sexual biology and its relationship to culture interesting, have a look at a book written by David Barash and his daughter, Nanelle Barash, and it's called Madame Bovary's Ovaries, and it's a Darwinian look at literature. And what they do is they go through fairly classic texts, and they sort of dissect it from the point of view of evolutionary theory, which is a kind of an emerging literary criticism kind of mode, is sort of look at it from a biological point of view. It asks questions about the motives of very famous literary figures like Cinderella, Othello. It's really hilarious and actually reminds me of some literature that I actually haven't read myself that I probably should. Actually, I have one more sex read to suggest, and it's called The Score, The Science of the Male Sex Drive by Faye Flam. And she's gone out and tried to decipher from a scientific point of view male sexual biology, and actually has a fair bit of scientific content behind it, but it's actually a short and good read as well. So that's it for the sex books. I have two other recommendations. There's an absolutely great illustrated sort of graphic novel version of Charles Darwin's Origin of Species by Michael Keller called Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species, a Graphic Adaptation. It's an extraordinarily well done, concise, and accurate version of The Origin of Species done in graphic novel format. And last but not least, Richard Dawkins. So Richard Dawkins' newest book called The Greatest Show on Earth is a lovely read. It's well illustrated. It uses lots of examples and just goes to the core of what is the evidence for evolution, presented in a Richard Dawkins way, well argued. We're currently using it for my undergraduate evolution class, and they're very enjoying it very much. So I encourage you to go out and get that. It's a great stocking stuffer, I think. So those are my recommendations, and have a happy holiday and enjoy your reading.
I want to read all of those books. We have just enough time for a quick plug of any science book that you loved but we didn't have time to get to.
How about, gosh, what's it called? Imagining Head Smashed In. It's about buffalo hunting on the plains of Alberta. It's a storytelling, history, archaeological look at that.
Nicely done. Mm. Next.
I want a second Demon Haunted World because that is a fantastic book. And throw in Contact, also by Carl Sagan, and The Infected Trilogy by Scott Sigler. Two of those books are out. Third one we're anxiously waiting for. That's fiction, by the way, but really awesome and science-y.
Dana?
There's one by Carl Zimmer. He did this ebook called Brain Cuttings, and it looks like it's going to be fantastic. I've read his book called Microcosm, and that was fantastic, I believe, about cell biology, but I'm really looking forward to reading the collection of Brain Cuttings.
And we are absolutely and completely out of time. Nicole, Kennedy, and Dana, thank you very much for being here.
Beauty.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you, Des.
And we are going to link to each and every one of these books in the episode show notes at skepticallyspeaking.com. That's how much we want to help you in your holiday gift-giving endeavors. And you can help us by clicking the links to Facebook, to Twitter, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show and leave a review. Heads up, we'll be airing pre-recorded episodes for the next 2 weeks so the team can have a well-deserved vacation. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week, but not live, on Skeptically Speaking. Happy holidays, everyone. If you still have money to burn after buying all those books, perhaps you'd like to contribute to the James Randi Educational Foundation's annual Season of Reason campaign, which runs from November 15th through January 15th. The JREF promotes critical thinking by reaching out to the public and to the media with reliable information about the paranormal and supernatural ideas that are so widespread in our society today. Last year's effort raised thousands of dollars, which was used to help establish the JREF's new education department and to get a number of new programs off the ground. This year, they're asking you to help raise $100,000 to help improve critical thinking and science education in schools and communities throughout North America and around the world. Also, the JREF is lucky enough to have an anonymous donor who is willing to give $1 for every dollar donated during the Season of Reason. And that's up to $100,000. And if you make an ongoing monthly pledge of $25 or more, or a one-time donation of $100 or more, you'll receive a limited edition Surly Remix holiday ornament. If you'd like to help spread the reach of reason this season, visit randy.org for more information or to donate.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking, our mind reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan, who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies, bring it on. The skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.